the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day, 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history. And
welcome to the Sake On Air podcast. My name is Justin Potts. I have with me...
My name is Sébastien Lemoine.
And I'm Christopher Hughes.
And this is the trio bringing you the world of sake here in Tokyo at the Sake and Shochu Information Center. Just a short hop, skip, and a jump from Tokyo Station. Today, what we are planning to dig into is something that is personally kind of dear to my heart. The idea of searching for sake here in Japan. Sake tourism. What there is in the present day for those discoveries and for those adventures, or the lack thereof. We're going to discuss where you might want to go to discover sake. Ideally, this will be a podcast. This will be an episode that people can go back and reference down the road. A lot of places are starting to finally invest a little bit more time, energy, and resources into making not just the breweries, but sake in these rural areas a bit more approachable and a little bit more accessible to more people. So this is becoming a more and more fun and engaging, and there's a lot out there, but it's still difficult to find information for a lot of these places. And so what we're going to kind of do is hopefully just share some stories and some places and some information for you, for our listeners, that they can then go back and reference down the road.
So Justin, are we tasting that sake now?
We've gone the Nigori route this time. We've got sake from Kikuhime in Ishikawa Prefecture.
So for those of our listeners that don't know, this is a sake which has been...
Thank you.
It's been filtered, so it's still sake. The definition is still sake. However, when they filter the sake, they use a filter with kind of holes in it, basically. So some of the solids go through with the liquid, and that's why it's this lovely opaque white color.
Kanpai.
Kanpai.
That's good. So this is a staple. These guys have it down. Those fine ladies and gentlemen at Kikuhime, they got it down here. So what have you gentlemen been up to? Anything excited?
Yeah.
Anything exciting you these days?
Absolutely. Actually, and it's somewhat related to our topic for the day. I mean, I was traveling around Tottori and Kyoto a few weeks back, and I visited a brewery called Mukai Shizo. And
I've seen photos.
Their brewery is located very near the sea in a beautiful cove, and they have this, I mean, the brewery has buildings on the two sides of the road, and so half of the buildings are actually facing the sea, and it's probably one of the best places to do a sake tasting or a sake meal. I mean, nothing comfortable, but just sitting on how do you call this, plastic, I mean, bottle racks, yeah. and enjoying your sandwich there is great. But that was not my point. What I did buy there is some sake kasu, so which are sake lees, so the solids after the fermenting mash has been pressed. And this was sake kasu from sake brewed from Kodai Mai, which means ancient rice, basically a red rice. Yeah. And I mean, I've been experiencing quite a bit with sake kasu and koji at home to marinate all sorts of food, but I was really, really happy, I should say, yeah, about the result of using this Kodai Mai sake kasu to let some, I think they were pork cutlets, mature for a couple of days in the fridge.
This sounds amazing.
When you use sake kasu as a marinade, you can mix it with a bit of miso. That's what I usually do. You really enhance the flavors of the food that you're marinating, and you're increasing its water retention. So you've got a very juicy meat with enhanced flavors. And somewhere the Kodai Mai, so this red rice sake kasu, adds some toasty cereal flavors to the pork. Actually, it was pork this time, and to be done again.
And of course, you can make a really good version of miso soup using the kasu, right? If you don't have the paste one, you have to mash it up into a paste. But if you Absolutely. You can also buy the kasu in like a paste form as well. It depends how the brewery presses their sake. If they press the sake using the old-fashioned method, it's going to be like a paste. And if they use the modern Yabata method, which is the name of the machine, then it's going to be like sheets. So you have to kind of mash it into a paste, which is a bit of work. But you just kind of sprinkle this stuff into your soup as you're making it. And it's lovely. It's really nice.
It's very lovely. It's very lovely. Really?
Notes of nice. Sake.
I said, yeah, I've seen pictures of that. You said it's close to the ocean. You're kind of understating it almost, in that
it's on the,
you're
yeah.
basically sitting, you're hovering over the ocean essentially,
yeah.
right?
yeah.
Very nice. Very good. Nice. Chris, what's been keeping you busy?
So I popped over to the Craft Sake Week Kit Kat.
Oh, did you make it over there?
Yes. Yeah, it was a really nice event, actually. It's a nice little hostel in Nihonbashi, yeah. which is...
Siten, right?
Yes, Siten. I don't know how you pronounce that now. Citan. Yeah. Great little hostel to go and stay. And so downstairs, they have like a little bar area and an open kitchen. And yeah, and some tables and chairs. And yeah, it was just basically pick a table and order a set of sake. So they had these sets of sake. I think every day it was a different, they were showcasing different breweries.
Yeah, just to kind of get people up to speed. So you said Craft Sake Week.
Mm.
This is an event that's been going the last couple of years. The season has changed, but it's been in the spring generally, April?
Yes.
This would be the end of April, where it's basically a 10 or 11 day sake festival hosted
yes.
in Roppongi.
Yes.
Where they bring 10, it's 10 different brewers
yes.
every single day, along with incredible food, and it's really approachable, and it's just really, really beautifully put together.
Yeah, if you kind of imagine, like, if you're in the US or the UK, if you imagine like Taste of London or Taste of New York or whatever, mm-hmm. the Taste of series of events mm-hmm. that they do for food in those various countries, it's a bit like that, really.
Yeah.
It's a sake version of that.
This one with Kit Kat, this was sort
yes.
of together with the reason for sake and Kit Kat is
yes.
they, right, so they've been doing collaborations for a while. There was
That's
previously
right.
a Nihonshu flavor or sake flavored
yep.
Kit Kat that came out, I believe, last year, 2 years ago.
Well,
years ago.
Every
years ago,
year,
renewed last year,
they rotate the breweries. So
right.
every year they get a different brewery to contribute their sake to make this Kit Kat. And I don't know what brewery we're on this year. I didn't actually take a look. But this particular event was marketing the Kit Kat, which they have made with Umeshu. A brewery in Wakayama Prefecture teamed up with them. And
Heiwa Shuzo, right?
Yes, Heiwa Shuzo.
Make kid,
yeah. And they make great sake. Yeah. But actually, when the current CEO took over the brewery, he actually started by innovating by making a new type of umeshu. He wanted to kind of make the brewery famous through umeshu, and then sake came later
yeah,
on.
Yeah, that really helped put him back on the map. Right?
That's right. But I have to say, this Kit Kat, and it wasn't what I expected, but in a good way. It's really clever what they've done. They've just basically captured the kind of aromatic part of the umeshu and imparted it in the chocolate. It's white chocolate. Oh, it's a great combination. Really, really nice. They just had these Kit Kats on the table for you to kind of try yourself. And then they had a selection of food. And then you could choose a sake set to pair with it. And the sake set I chose was set A. And that was Jiyondai, Hakuko, and Masuizumi. All three, you know, very famous breweries.
Yeah.
Very good brands.
Very nice. I'm sad. That's already over, isn't it?
Yeah, sadly yeah. that's over. But there'll be more.
Right.
And, you know, when you come to Japan, be sure to check out the internet for craft sake events that might be happening. Because they're fairly regular.
Very nice. How about, should we dig into a bit of news here? It's not Nihonshu related per se, but there is a soy sauce producer called Yamadoku Soy Sauce. They're down on Shodo Island, Shodoshima,
mm-hmm.
Down in Kagawa Prefecture. And so for the last, gosh, how many years now? It's been, the project, I want to say it's probably been going for about 4 or 5 years, but they've been investing a lot of time and energy into helping redevelop the craftsmanship and the people who have the craftsmanship and the ability to make what are referred to as kioke.
Mm-hmm.
These are these large wooden barrels that are used for the fermentation mash, for sake, for soy sauce, for miso, for things like that. The number of people who actually have the skill in order to craft these things, you can pretty much count on about one hand nowadays. So this is a treasure to not just the world of sake, but Japan's food culture in general that is seriously in danger of actually being lost. Mm. There is a real danger of that. And Yamadoku soy sauce has been really, really proactive, probably have the most proactive project out there, and really getting people involved and being able to learn in that process and train sort of the next generation of people to be able to make these things. And they recently was back in 2015, they had the expo in Milan, and for that they brought over a gyoke for display, like a big one they made. It's kind of part of their project when they were getting their project going, and to display and to kind of share this craftsmanship and do that. What came out of that was a collaboration with Baladin, which is the first quote-unquote craft beer producer in Italy. And what they've done is they've done a collaboration using that gyoke and maturing that beer for about 18 months. And that beer is just about to be released. So finding avenues, new interesting avenues for using these kyoke, and then using that with kind of a pioneering craft beer place like that overseas and making an original beer. I just saw that and it just kind of warmed my heart.
Absolutely. And it'd be great to see more breweries reviving the kyoke as well, right? Because they switched over to stainless steel. And of course, that's why a lot of breweries don't use them. And they are quite hard work to manage. And you also need to use them over a period of time, because the idea is that they trap like particles of yeast and other microbes and things inside the gaps inside the wood, and they impart these kind of flavors later on when you're actually making the sake, which can be desirable and not desirable. It depends, you know, what type of sake you're trying to make. But it's nice to see this tradition.
You're starting to see a bit more demand, which is really, really nice. But even the places who do want those now are unable to get them because there's no one to make them, they're too expensive. Mm. Or, and it's not just a matter of making them or repairing the ones that are already out there. And that's a big problem, especially for a lot of like soy sauce producers and things like that, is that you've got places that have been using these things for 90, 100, 110, 20 years that they maybe don't have to make a new one, but to repair these things, that's a big chore as well too.
Yeah, talking about tourism, actually, when you visit a brewery and you have a kyoke or a wooden koshiki, which is the equipment used to steam the rice, it creates a much stronger impression.
Mm, it really
contributes to this craftsmanship image that that sake
really
has.
Does. And it's not a one-to-one because they're used differently, obviously, but, you know, say you look at the world of wine and, you know, you've got wine barrels, things like that.
Yes.
As well, too, as far as keeping up production on those and place using those. But nowhere near to the degree of kyoke in Japan. Kyoke. And I mean, imagine visiting... I mean, there are wineries now that it may not, you know, that may not
necessarily
to mature in oak. They may use strictly stainless and things like that. But when you go and you pay visits and you to these places, you want to see that, right? And I mean, imagine a world with no oak in the world of wine. I mean, the world of no kyoke in Japan is a very real one. That's a real possibility.
Yeah.
That's something that's really, for me, is really scary. So I'm
agreed.
It's kind of a personal mission to kind of get the word out there. And so to hear about this was very, very
And do you remember that brewery we visited? We helped out with the tour. It was it Masuichi, I think, in Nagano, and they had an amazing kyoke in their like that restaurant that we went to. You remember that
Masuichi? Yes.
Breathtaking.
She has done a lot of work actually in I don't hear about her work so much recently, but about 10 years ago was it Sarah Cummings? She actually spent a lot of time really investing in sort of the revitalization of
I had the pleasure of listening to her lovely presentation when I first came to Japan.
Oh, very nice.
2014. Very nice lady. And very inspiring story. Should interview her.
Very nice.
But I really like the way you brought us into the topic there, Sebastian. And I think kyoke is one of those things, like one of the first things that comes to mind when I think of sake tourism is the architecture of these breweries. No two breweries are the same, right? They're all different in some way or other. Many breweries, they don't have the original buildings that they had, you know, all those years ago, but they have some parts, right? Some parts of the brewery are still the original brewery, and then other parts are kind of tagged on or have been renovated or whatever. But it's just that aroma. You know, anyway, you get that aroma, right? When you walk into a really old brewery, it's magical.
I said, and you can, a lot of them, as you mentioned, they are kind of been patchworked together over the years as production has grown and then dropped off, and they've been sort of depending on the needs of different generations. You can kind of time travel just strolling through the brewery of parts of the brewer were built 150, 200 years ago, and then 100 years ago, and then 50 years ago, and then we've just built this new tasting room over here. And so you're kind of traveling through several generations, just sort of strolling through the brewery, and it can be really interesting. It can be jarring in some cases, but in some cases it's really, really fascinating.
I mean, sometimes I was maybe lucky because I asked, but the Kuramoto, so the brewery owner, gave me access to the attic. Yeah. So the place where they store all the old equipment and tools. Yeah. So this is really a traveling time.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It's such a magical experience. And I can relate to that when I visited Kenkon Ichi in Miyagi, and they have a similar type of brewery. And I remember him telling me this wall is this era and this wall is this era. And the beams, you know, in the roof, they're very the traditional Japanese beams where they don't use nails to stick them together. They kind of interlock them like not Lego bricks, but Jenga, basically, like the game Jenga, right?
Mm, yeah, but there's no slots in Jenga.
Yeah,
right?
There's no slots in Jenga. So that's very true.
Like,
that's true. Yeah.
Tetris.
Yes. Maybe? Yeah. The brewery version of Tetris. But yeah, it's great. So architecture is a big thing. What?
Yeah. Before we dig in there. So first, is there sake tourism in Japan? Is that a thing?
Straight off. Yes.
Does that exist?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. What does it look like? Is it different from? So a lot of people. There's a lot more beer tourism nowadays. Wine tourism is something that has transformed economies of regions. What is sake tourism? How is it similar or different from those?
I mean, yes, clearly there is sake tourism, but sake tourism can be developed much more, and actually will develop much more. And I guess we'll look at some of the reasons why it has to be developed, or what needs to be done to develop it. I just want to start with one point is sake tourism should be international, like open to every visitor. And sometimes in Japan, I feel that sake tourism for Japanese people or Japanese speaking people is a much larger world than sake tourism for foreigners visiting Japan. Mm.
And I think that speaks sort of to not just the sake tourism, but sort of the larger nature of just travel in Japan and the way that the tourism industry has sort of built up historically. Japan, a lot of times it gets referred to being an island in a number of situations, and that's very much the case here, and that it was able to develop a large market with entertainment and activities and forms of travel built around a very specific market with different needs and interests from the international market. Now that the population is decreasing, interests are changing, you're starting to see a lot of rural areas of Japan that aren't necessarily as pretty as they used to be. They're beautiful, beautiful old areas, but a lot of the old lodging establishments, a lot of the old restaurants, all of these things, they haven't been kept up, and they're not as beautiful as they clearly once were because demands have changed, the market has changed, the people that are going out and traveling, visiting, what they're looking for in these different experiences has changed a great deal, and it's very much different from the type of travel that has been common for the last several generations that the entire industry had really built up around. And so, and with sake industry or with sake breweries not being a real destination as part of that, not only did you have an industry that was sort of developed without other interests and other visitors and things like that in mind, you also had a chunk of those local resources being the breweries that were not really integrated into even the pre-existing model.
Yeah, because so you've kind of got the thing that we have to make people understand, especially if you want to go and visit a brewery and you get turned down, which can be a little bit deflating, you know, especially if you've got this passion for sake and you're, why are they turning me down? I just want to see inside the brewery. I want to see, you know, it's important to understand that maybe the biggest difference between wineries, especially the chateau, is that a lot of them have these glorious buildings that they can show you around, but they're not actually using the buildings to make the wine, right? So they're free to do that. But what you have to understand about sake breweries is this: most of these buildings are being used to make the sake. And it's actually quite a dangerous environment in there, you know, when they're making the sake. And there, perhaps we'll cover this in more detail in another podcast, but you have to maintain a certain kind of microbially stable environment inside the brewery. And if you have lots of people coming in from outside, you're going to, you know, you're not going to be able to do that. And so traditionally, breweries have to kind of keep their breweries closed. There are other reasons why they might not be able to open up the breweries to English-speaking people, but a lot of the breweries are not even open for Japanese-speaking tourists either. But it's important to understand why that is. And I think the reason why a lot of breweries have started to open themselves up now is because the brewery is being seen as the key to reviving a lot of these, you know, kind of lagging, what's the word, these kind of flagging, you know, towns. The population is decreasing and, you know, everyone's moving out to Tokyo into the big cities, and these breweries are being seen as maybe the draw to bring people back into the towns. And the buzzword is sake tourism, of course, tourism, just in general.
So, Sebastian, do you go and visit wineries in France?
Enotourisme, yeah. Wine tourism is a major contribution to the tourism industry in France. France is receiving 10 million visitors in wineries and, I would say, wine fields. And 50%, close to 50% of these travelers, I think between 40 and 50% of these travelers are actually foreigners. Mm. So that's why I was mentioning that point about the difficult access that sometimes foreigners have here.
Mm. Yeah, and that's insane for countries like, it wasn't too long ago that I spent some time going to New Zealand annually, taking farmers, actually, from Japan over looking at some sort of agriculture-related projects. And one thing I would look at is wine tourism. And it's a bit of a different situation from Japan, obviously, in that they're much more reliant on exports, being such a small population-wise compared to Japan. So they're in a bit of a different situation, but you've got areas where, you know, you'll go and visit and say, yeah, there was nothing here 20 years ago. Mm. There was maybe a winery or two 20 years ago, and you've got just a beautiful, beautiful network of collaboration of not just the wineries, but local restaurants, local dining, activities, art galleries, all these things. It's no struggle whatsoever to go and hunt out down these experiences. You just basically have to Google winery visit or wine tour in the area that you're after, and you've got plenty of options ready available, and they're all really, generally really high quality experiences. Right.
It's really about art de vivre, actually,
yeah.
Beyond the alcoholic beverage itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's something that I think is going to be really key for getting sake breweries back being sort of central to those regions again. A lot of times they really were. Traditionally, they were very central to these communities and to these areas. And so once again, sort of they're really iconic. We were talking about the architecture. They're very central presence-wise. Another thing would maybe be like temples or shrines or things like that. But aside from that, what do you have in all of these areas that really signify Japan, especially maybe to a lot of non-Japanese visitors, is a brewery can be a really, really...
I think all they need is the infrastructure, a lot of these towns, like to run this kind of sake tourism. You know, I think maybe some of them lack accommodation, for example, or, you know, no problem with the other things to see. They've got, you know, plenty of things that you can see and do, but perhaps on the infrastructure side, they are a little bit lacking, especially for catering for, you know, tourists from overseas. Justin, have you seen anything happening that you know, suggests that maybe we're not that far off of having our own little Napa Valley experience in Japan?
I think it's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
So everybody's paying, especially in this sense, just sake in general, they tend to pay attention to what the wine industry is doing in other countries as a point of reference for what's maybe possible. And sake tourism, sakagura tourism, essentially sake brewery tourism, has been kind of a big buzzword through the bit. Lots of push from the Japanese government and to really help build up, help support these types of projects. So not just individual breweries, but areas that are putting together the infrastructure to be able to offer these different types of experiences, as well as helping fund or support breweries that are willing to invest in the infrastructure to be able to bring on tourists and things like that.
Because it's sort of a new concept, it's important to foster exchanges between the breweries to define best practices or what can be best practices. Mm-hmm. And these best practices are not the same for every client, obviously.
Absolutely.
Because you've got four different populations that want to visit a winery or a brewery. I mean, you have the tourist who has no particular interest in the product itself, but happens to be here looking for a fun experience, something new to discover, a bit of education, some fun, and sometimes there are groups. You have the amateur who is coming to that particular place because he wants to learn about it, about its products, about its story, and is much more individualistic in his attitude. He wants sort of a personalized experience. You've got the opinion leader, the scout, like the journalist, critic, that is coming to learn about the place and will publish about it later on. And you have a very high-end clientele as well, looking for exclusive experiences, exclusive dining experiences, exclusive lodging experiences, an exclusive visit of the place, and an exclusive tasting. So best practices and the way to handle these clients will be different, but fostering exchanges about these practices will help, I think, the development of sake tourism.
Yes. Getting feedback from the people who visit as well, right? That's also important, getting feedback from the people who come and visit these breweries.
They are predisposed to anticipating a certain type of experience, and they're open to it being different to a degree, of course, because they're in Japan, they want something uniquely Japanese. But at the same time, people have certain expectations. So how do you fulfill those, especially when you're looking at possibly, you know, more higher-end clientele or people that are used to having maybe certain services associated with wine and travel and lodging and dining and things like that. So there's a great deal of education that's taking place at the moment.
And bouncing back on what you just said and what Chris was saying earlier, sake tourism could benefit from really bringing together under a single label in a particular town, in a particular region, all those who contribute to the experience. So not the brewery only, but the transportation company,
yes,
the firm that is going to propose a nature trail, for example. I mean, of course, I'm thinking, I have my French roots, and I'm thinking of everything you can do in vine fields in France, and it's a lot of fun. The restaurants, the hotels, and bring all these people under a single banner, a single label.
Right, many people and organizations look at the breweries to take responsibility and do this, but I don't think that's really fair because, you know, the breweries have to brew sake. They're pretty busy already as it is. It kind of does need someone else to take the initiative. And I hear a lot of breweries crying out they'd love tourism to happen, you know, in their local area, but they can't take on that responsibility of trying to organize it themselves, you know. They're opening themselves up to tourists, but obviously that isn't enough. They know that's not enough, but that's as much as they can really do. Maybe we should dig into like where people should go. Like, should we give some suggestions of where people might want to visit, and like what should they expect from a typical brewery visit?
Well, I guess you can kind of break it down. So you've got breweries that you can visit that will give you a very educational experience. I guess you can go and learn not just about where you're at, but about sake. What is sake? You can get a tour. You can get experiences. So for people who are going to a sake brewery for that educational experience, they want to learn about sake versus just places that offer just really nice experiences. They might have a nice tasting room, nice dining. It may not be a super educational experience, but it makes for a really lovely afternoon. And it's on the brewery level, but then you also have kind of the regional level where you can go and spend a day or two or three and visit maybe a couple of breweries, but also be able to easily integrate a lot of other types of experiences and things like that.
Some of these breweries have really surprising facilities. You know, like there's one in Kanagawa Prefecture that makes the brand Tensei, Kumazawa Shuzo. And I lost track of all the things you could do in this one brewery. You know, it's not a massive brewery by any means, but, you know, you can easily fill half a day, you know, visiting that brewery. And I think that will come as a surprise to a lot of people who just expect this kind of factory, maybe, making sake. There's so much more to discover.
And that's typically a place where you don't get too much of the education and you don't see too much insight. That's really about the experience in your classification.
Right. Yeah.
But I agree, it's a great destination.
But you don't need to, right? You don't need to see the whole process maybe in your first visits. Maybe, you know, as you get to know more brewers and you get to, you find a sake that you fall in love with, and maybe you can find your way into the brewery, into one of their little, you know, making experiences, production experiences or something. It's not, like, what I want to say is it's not normal to be able to go into a brewery and see the sake being made. You know, as explained earlier, these places are quite dangerous environments. It's a lot of responsibility on the brewer's part to actually bring people in and into that dangerous environment, look after them and show them the process in a way which is understandable and meaningful.
Absolutely.
Do you know any breweries, Justin, where you can go and you can have this educational experience?
I mean, I know at least two which are close to each other, and I'm talking about the Nada sake producing area. So we are near Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
Nada was, I mean, still is the biggest sake production region in the world by far. And that's where you have a high concentration of large and smaller brewers.
Yes.
And some of these houses with a long history there, Hakutsuru or Hakushika, they have transformed their historical kura, so their historical breweries, into museums of sake making. Another example is the Okura Museum of Geikan.
Yes, I was going to add Geikan.
In Kyoto, in Fushimi. Yeah. I mean, these are great places to learn about sake history and the craft that goes into it.
So, yeah, well, along those lines, getting at sort of that larger scale, I was actually just down in Saijo recently, down in Hiroshima, and like Kamotsuru is just, it's like Kamotsuru town down there. And you can just wander for days, and there's a whole lot to really pick through and really kind of take in the environment there. And it's kind of an interesting environment as well, whereas 5 minutes from the station, you have this concentration of 8-9 breweries, and they're all really unified in sort of their visual style as well, and sort of construction. They have these sheer white walls just lining all the streets, and you can just kind of waltz in and out of. And I said this kind of goes beyond education, but and goes out and a little bit to more to the experience. But it's a place where you can kind of get lost almost in this this little maze of little white walls.
It's like the Harry Potter, place, right?
Absolutely.
You turn the corner, you're in the what's called Diagon Alley.
Exactly. It is the Diagon Alley of the sake world, without a doubt. Because you can wander in, you're on this white wall maze, but then you can duck into all these little side streets, and all of a sudden you're in a little shop that sells this and that and the other thing, and it's a very easy to go and get lost for half a day there. And it's really, really accessible.
There are a surprising, large amount of these kind of sake streets, aren't there? Sake brewery streets.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we were talking about the infrastructure. Clearly, access and communication into cities, into and inside cities is easier than what I would call the countryside. So, indeed, some of the destinations that come to my mind easily, if you want to visit a number of breweries, are these cities with a sake brewing tradition. So you mentioned Saijo in Hiroshima, but Suwa in Nagano is another place where you have all these breweries on the same street, along the same street, and they actually do a great event twice a year, the Miyaruki, where which means drinking while walking, where they team up together and you buy a ticket that gives you a glass, basically, and you can take sake from each of the breweries. That's a lot of fun. And another one is Takayama. I mean, Takayama, more than Suwa today, is often on the itineraries of foreigners visiting Japan. Takayama is one of these areas.
In Gifu, it's national heritage, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Where you have national a number heritage. Of breweries that are accessible. I mean, here again, you don't see too much of the production process.
That's
but,
true.
But there are beautiful buildings. Mm-hmm. And if you pay attention within these tasting rooms or around them, there are lots of objects that talk about sake brewing and culture.
A lot of them have nice little shops, don't they?
Yes.
You know, that you can just kind of walk around, and that's quite... Funazawa Shuzo, isn't it? Funazaka Shuzo, sorry. Yeah, that has the lovely... really, really big shop. I mean, you could lose yourself in that shop. And they have this amazing courtyard as well, and a lovely little restaurant.
Great experience.
That's what I mean. Like, you just go to these breweries and you don't expect, you know, anything more than maybe just like a quick sake tour or anything. But a lot of them, I think you can have a better time there if the sake tour isn't the main feature, if you've got other kind of things you can do as well. And I just want to point out that you don't have to go as far as Hida Takayama or Gifu. You know, there are great breweries if you come to Tokyo, which, let's face it, is the gateway into Japan, right? So you arrive here. Maybe, you know, you've only got a day or two. You don't know what you're going to do. Visit a brewery in Tokyo. Tokyo has breweries. Not many, but we've got some left. And you have to go a little bit outside, you know, the center. But an hour away by train to Fusa is the marvelous Ishikawa Shuzo. And I would just describe their brewery as a sake theme park. With beer as well, if you like beer.
Yeah.
They've got their own Soba restaurant. They've got another restaurant. Italian. I think they opened recent Italian restaurant. They will do a tour. Even without an appointment, you know, there's someone who, there are a lot of staff who can speak English. It's a quick, no frills tour, but if it's your first tour,
for a lot first of people, tour, and that's really important, is to be able magical. To have it's like, where can I hop on a train, be somewhere in 30 minutes to an hour, go enjoy myself, learn a little something,
right?
Taste, have something good, spend 2 or 3 hours, and.
Yeah.
Beyond my next thing. That's really, really valuable for.
And if you feel that going all that way just for one brewery is a bit, you know, it's a bit of a trek. The good news is that there's another two breweries you can visit in the vicinity. There's Sawanoi, and they've been doing, you know, sake experience or tours or, you know, for a long time now. But again, it's not just a brewery. You've got all this, you've got this little restaurant town, and it's on a hiking trail. So there's all these natural spots you can visit. There's a koma museum, a Japanese traditional koma museum, which I popped into. It's quite interesting. It's great to go in the summer and in the spring with the cherry blossoms. And then there's another one, which is a much smaller experience, to be fair, but there's Tamamura Shuzo, which is very close to Sawanoi. The brewery visit isn't much, but the gardens are amazing. And they have this old kiyaki tree, you know, the I think it's like 600 years old or something, this tree. And it's supposed to, people go there because they think it's a spiritual energy spot. And I touched the tree, I didn't feel anything. But, you know, if you believe in that type of thing.
And near Ishikawa Shuzo, if you really want to make two breweries in the same day, you have Tamura as well.
Yeah, Tamura, sorry. Yeah, Tamura.
You have to book
the That's right.
experience yes. online. But, I mean, Ishikawa and Tamura share this culture. I mean, they were owned by former village heads who had the responsibility under the shogun to, I mean, they were taking care of certain tasks and duties. I think, was it Ishikawa or Tamura, one of the two, was responsible for supplying ayu, which is river fish, for the
sweet fish,
sweet fish for the Korean embassies or something like that. So that was the main role in the shogunate. But they were brewing sake as well, and so they were wealthy families. And Ishikawa Shuzo, the buildings are part of Tokyo's heritage, or maybe Tokyo. Japan's heritage. I'm not sure. Absolutely gorgeous. So,
how did you get that information? You had a long talk with the.
Been there a few times.
Sebastian's good at prying out information and digging deep.
And finally, for Tokyo, there's one right in the 23 wards of Tokyo. There used to be two, but it's just one. But there's one in right next door to Tokyo Tower. I mean, in the vicinity of Tokyo Tower. I don't know if they do tours, but they're very open. You know, if you want to go and visit the brewery, I'm sure that's not a problem. And so there you go. You don't have to go that far.
Yeah, you were talking about Mikasa Tensei as well. That sort of brought to mind. And then what I think a lot of people forget is Hakkaisan up in Niigata is actually really, really, really accessible. Mm. And it's beautiful up there. They don't have a big tour set up. What they do is they have one room where they have their snow cave for storage.
Yes, I've seen photos of that, yeah.
Where they have a number of tanks in there, and they keep it cold all year round because they've got just mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds of snow stuffed in there. And so you can just kind of stroll through that, and then you go out into a tasting room. And it kind of gets forgotten because it's a little bit of a trip from the closest station. You probably have to, it's a little bit of an access issue, but you can take a bullet train, get up there, hop a taxi. It's about a 20-minute taxi ride, but you can easily go and spend the whole day because it is just a field in the station alone.
You have this sake vending machine.
Oh, so that's far away,
right?
But that's really far away. So
okay.
That's way up in the city of Niigata. So they're a little more south, more south Niigata. But they have soba place, pizza place, bakery, sweets, another shop. They've got, again, Kaisan makes beer. Now they make a lot of amazake. Mm. They have all this. You can just spend a half day up there, and it's absolutely beautiful. You're in the foothills of the mountains of Hakkaisan. You're staring up at Hakkaisan, and you're surrounded by greenery. And yeah. it's really, really beautiful. And it takes no effort, and it takes no sake knowledge to be able to go out. There's one close
to Niigata Station as well. You've got Asahi Shuzo as well, make the Kubota brand, and they've got their own restaurant.
So they're not by Niigata Station. So they're
they're a train ride away. To be fair, so it's like one of the first other two stations away, I think, isn't it?
So they're in Nagaoka.
But it's certainly accessible.
For anybody who's got a rail pass.
Yes, they don't
need the rail pass. They don't have to think twice.
You need the rail pass. But that's another great place to go. And Sebastian?
I was saying, coming back to Hakkaisan, they've been contributing a lot to the world of sake education.
Yeah, absolutely.
Made really interesting, classic, but interesting movies, footage, I should say, about sake brewing. Yeah. So, you get the education as well there.
Absolutely. And they have they've set up shops around, they've sort of have a whole other side business on sort of like fermented food products and local products and stuff like that that are really developed around Tokyo. So there is access to their products, not just their products, but a lot of food in and around Tokyo as well too.
Yes.
Which is a really, really, they tend to kind of fly, everybody knows the name, but they kind of fly under the radar a little bit for some of these other activities that they're actually really, really proactive on or building a really beautiful model around. And it's a really, it's easy to recommend.
That brings one idea to my mind. It's not really tourism, but about sake discovery when you travel through Japan. I mean, there's a shop I often go to in Ginza. It's actually Fukumitsuya. A Kanazawa brewing company located in Kanazawa. And they made the decision to open their own retail shops.
Yeah.
And you have a few across Tokyo. And they're not only selling sake, selling
ice cream, right?
Ice cream, sake vessels, sake kasu, koji. I mean, a very large number of elements of sake culture.
They do.
Which breweries have we not mentioned?
We can't mention them all. We should probably preface this with we don't know everywhere. We have not been to everywhere. I've heard beautiful stories about so many places that are up to really, really fantastic work.
Yeah.
I have a long, long list of to go places. This is not by any means a definitive list in any way, shape or form. We're just kind of trying to offer a few ideas for a few possible suggestions or places that might be worth checking out, because this is something that's really important and can really add to an experience, an itinerary in Japan for people who are visiting or for people who are already here who are looking for things to do or ways to get out of the countryside as well too. I would hope that there's maybe some people listening who live in Japan. Maybe they've been here for a long time and they feel like they've seen and done a lot, but there's actually a lot of places that you can pop out and go and explore.
Why don't we end with absolute favorite sake visits, sake brewery visits?
That's like selecting your children again, having to choose. And as somebody who has a couple, I know, I have trouble with that. There's a couple that just kind of come to mind is Izumibashi, just down in Kanagawa, south of Tokyo. So that's within an hour. They're really focused on rice production as well. So that's really right there. So you can kind of see
the real rice fields from start to finish. Yeah.
They start things out there, so you get sort of that educational experience, while at the same time, they got a really lovely restaurant on site there.
They just opened up, yeah.
Yeah, so you can go through and get that whole experience kind of from the rice field through the brewing process, and they tend to focus on Kimoto and those traditional styles of production as well, so you can kind of...
And near the train station.
And it's
a walk away. You can walk from the train station.
Yep. Yeah. So that's a nice one.
You know my Honke?
Yeah, I have to say, I actually have not been out there
yet. I've been twice.
I've heard really good things. I've heard they've put together a pretty good educational program where they got the tour and they actually teach you and sit you down and do tastings and stuff.
Really good.
And I've heard really good things.
Great shop. And they have a little restaurant. It's only a hop and skip, away from the center of Tokyo, but it's a completely different part of Japan.
Absolutely. I would say a couple of regions that I would really, really recommend. The Noto Peninsula.
Oh, yes. I haven't been yet, but I so want to go. Yeah.
Fantastic. First time I went, I was kind of shocked that this Japan still exists. Mm-hmm. There's just this beautiful cohesiveness out there in the countryside, not just the breweries, but just the nature of the homes, sort of the construction, the architecture. It's absolutely beautiful. And you've got different areas like the Wajima area. You're just within walking distance. You've got, I believe, five producers that are all right there. Markets, the town is lovely. if you extend to sort of the larger region in on the peninsula, you've got places like Sogen. Sogen is really great. So I'm not sure how accessible their tours are right yet. I'm not sure. They've got some kind of interesting stuff set up there where they've got kind of the train line runs right behind their brewery. It's a train line that is no longer functioning. They put a little trolley kind of on there, and you can go and you can kind of ride that into the tunnel, and they actually use that for stock storage for sake now. And so you can go and buy your sake there, and then you can leave it there too.
Ah, that reminds me of Azumarikushi in Tochigi.
Okay.
They have this bat cave where they store all their sake, and you can go and visit.
Nice. But the difference is that at Sogen, you can you buy sake from them, and they store it for you. Is that the case for Azumarikushi?
Yes, it's the same. Okay, all right. It's quite expensive, though, because most people are doing it as like a kind of an inheritance gift for their son or daughter when they become of age. I don't see many, you know, overseas visitors or people going in and buying. But maybe, is that what you can do at Sogen, then? It's quite
Yeah, I'm client affordable. Number 100.
Oh.
I've got a couple of stages there.
Yeah.
And nice. I give a shout out to Wakazakari in Tochigi, another one in Tochigi, Oyama City, very, very, very accessible. And it's so big. I mean, the shop is massive. And I think they do tours as well. Actually, it's quite. They often do like a festival once a year around the new year, just after the new year, which is nice to go and visit. Very close to Tokyo.
Very nice, yeah.
Yeah.
Northern Gunma.
Yeah, yeah.
That way, it's beautiful up that way. You've got four producers. What you've
got Nagai Shuzo,
yeah. You've got Okane Shuzo.
Yeah.
You've got Tsuchida Shuzo.
Yeah, Tsuchida Shuzo, yeah.
And then, what was it? The other one's Nagai Honke.
Yeah, Nagai Honke. Right. So we actually did a tour. The Sake 2020 actually went on a tour. We took a bus up there.
I wasn't able to make that one.
Yeah, and it was amazing. I mean, they have an amazing garden and temple called Kichijoji, which is, I've been there twice now, once in the autumn leave Koyo season, and then on this tour, and it was a bit colder and whiter. But yeah, that's an amazing place to go and drink tea and look at the lovely scenery.
So, yeah, just that whole area. The really nice thing is they've got beer breweries, they've got wineries, and then it's a big region for adventure tourism, outdoor tourism. So if you go, there's rafting, canyoning, hiking, climbing, all these other things. And it's just beautiful up there. It's just seasonally really, really distinct. And they've got it set up to where it's pretty accessible with buses and things like that. And a lot of the producers there are pretty collaborative. So they know what one another are doing, the experiences that one another are offering. So you can go in there and get really distinct experiences at those different places. So it was really, really, really lovely.
I think the question is a bit tough for me because sake tourism is very important to my activity.
Yeah, absolutely.
I visited a number of them with clients. In terms of public visits, there is one I want to mention. I was talking about Nada earlier, about Kobe. This is a pretty intimidating environment. This is the area where these breweries are located. Is not really nice. You're kind of squeezed between the highway and the Nippon Steel mill.
Yeah.
So it's not a lot of fun. So you have to find some oasis. Yeah. And I mean, some of them are these museums. I was talking about the Akutsuru Historical Museum, but a great brewery that I mean, one of my best experiences in terms of public visit was actually Yasufuku. The way you are welcomed and the tasting experience and the brewery visit itself is really worth a small detour if you're in this area.
Nice.
I think we've sold sake tourism, right? This should have sold sake tourism. So, if you were only sold on the idea.
There's one thing I like to talk about is sometimes the moment of slight uneasiness at the end of the tour when you've tasted a few sake and you're about to leave. And when you're visiting from abroad, it's true that to buy sake, especially large quantities of sake, with you or just to take with you for travel. That's a conversation we've had many times, Justine. Yeah. But in terms of best practice, I definitely encourage the brewers to charge some minimal fee for the tour and for the tasting, and hopefully that would make the...
Well, even if they don't do that, let's just, when you visit a brewery, you know, it probably doesn't cost you anything to see the brewery. So just buy a bottle of something. Just, you know, get an apron or something, you know, some soap or cake or whatever. Just made out of cassava. Buy something.
Right. I said, if you're adventurous, for better or worse, right now you can go on have some pretty incredible experiences.
Yep.
If you're patient, you can have some pretty incredible experiences for next to nothing, which
yep.
is probably going to change, and honestly, ideally, probably should change for all the reasons that Sebastian was mentioning, is because
yep.
you get a huge, huge time and energy investment for a really unique experience that can still has room to be developed as well too. And so, investing in that experience is what's really going to help them to then further develop that and be able to build something even more interesting and exciting, and something that can then feed back into the region and the brewers and the farmers and all those lovely people that help make it all possible. So with that, I'm not going to lie, I have a train to catch. We're going to wrap it up. Before we check out here, does anybody have any last words of wisdom? Anything to share that they have to get in there before they...
Go visit a sake brewery if you're coming to Japan. You know, it might not already be on your itinerary, but please add a sake brewery.
Go to a sake brewery because you'll get much more than sake. Actually,
yes,
yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
Well said.
I'm going to leave it at that because that's exactly what we're going for. A lot of the places there's no way we could have covered everywhere today. For those who did not get mentioned, we will integrate you again when we do round two somewhere down the road. We love you all. Until then, thank you very much to all of our listeners and all of those sake curious or sake travelers and everybody out there looking for a lovely sake experience. Where can we find both of you guys? Where, if we're looking for more information for your guys' activities and what's going on?
I have a website. It's www.sakenotabibito.com.
And I have a blog, sebastianlemoine.wordpress.com, which links to my company's website as well.
And you can find me at www.potsk.com. And this little podcast is made possible with the help of the Sake 2020 project. If you Google Sake 2020, I'm sure it will come up. You can find information there. And we do this with the support of the Sake and Shochu Makers Association. If you're in the Tokyo area and you're looking for a brewery to visit, a good place to start is the Sake and Shochu Information Center in Tokyo that is very close to the station. We hope you will come and check it out. For us, this is what we've got today. If you have any questions, feedback, show ideas, or anything of that nature, if you just want to say hello, you can reach us at questions@sakeonair.com or on all social media, most of the regular ones at Sake On Air. And you can find us on YouTube and SoundCloud and all that good stuff. So hopefully we will see you in another couple of weeks. Thank you both, gentlemen. And
thank you, Justin. Yeah,
cheers to you guys.
Cheers.
Final kanpai.
Kanpai. All right.